As most of you know, I've been gone for a little over 2 weeks, maybe close to three. I went on a journey first to Italy, and then I went on a pilgrimage for the second time to Israel. There is a great deal to say about that, but I'm not going to say it today. I'll say it tomorrow. There'll be a satsang at Chela Bhavan, where I live, in the community. It'll be at 7 o'clock, and it'll, for those watching online, it'll also be live-streamed and then posted later. I'll say simply that it was really a glorious trip, life-changing, and I'm very grateful for your support and your friendship that traveled with me all the way. There is much that it may creep into what I say today, because I was listening to, as I'm listening to Barbara sing the Beatitudes, I have a picture of a place for that now. You know, one goes to the Mount of Beatitudes where churches have been built and trees planted and an entire 2,000 years later universe created based on those words and those actions. When I first traveled to India, which was in 1986, yes, 86, and visited the house of Lahiri Mahashaya and the place where Sri Yukteswar, his body is buried, the home where Master grew up, although Master's life was mostly in America, so you can feel his vibration also in Los Angeles, the places that he was. But when I first returned from India for the first time and came back here and was doing the arati, which we do at the end of our service to each of the masters, I was aware of the fact that I had a different relationship because I'd experienced the vibration in a way that I hadn't before. Now, in theory, none of this is required geographically because it's all within us one way or another. But being creatures of this world, we do experience this world and it helps us. I remember when I was living in my little trailer back in the early 70s at Ananda Village, my bed was laid out here and there was a sort of shelf above and I had pictures of all the gurus and a picture of Swamiji up there. And one night in the middle of the night, Babaji's picture just flipped off the shelf and landed on my chest and woke me up. None of the others even tipped over, but that one just plunged to my chest, which I sort of decided maybe there's something I need to relate to here. So it happens in our spiritual life either by being called on a pilgrimage, as I was, to my own surprise this time, or being woken up in the night because a framed picture crashes down on your chest, something will happen that begin to progress us in our spiritual life. As I mentioned, this was the second trip I'd taken to Israel, and after the first one, I didn't think I was going to go again. I felt, well, I've done that, but something called me. And so our whole life is this process, whether it's dramatic and then we buy a ticket and get on an airplane and transport ourselves a big distance, or whether it just happens in the middle of the night all alone when inexplicably one of the gurus literally taps you on the chest. There are these wonderful stories in autobiography of a yogi about how Master himself was tapped on the chest by his guru Sri Yukteswar, and it put him into a state of cosmic consciousness. Swamiji remarks that the autobiography is a little misleading because Master is so humble and presents himself in such a humble way. He said that a lot of enthusiastic people went to India and sort of stood around on street corners, you know, waiting for someone to just tap them on the chest, not really understanding that it's a two-way street, that the Master can't tap you on the chest unless, or the touch will have no effect, but most likely he won't even be inclined to do it until everything in one's own karma is aligned. And I was driving home. It's taken me most of a week to get back. For many days, every time I go to sleep, I was still dreaming mostly that I was in Jerusalem. When my sleep, I was still in Jerusalem. In my waking, I knew I was in California, which was a little disconcerting. But finally, I'm back. One always comes back eventually. And I'm driving to where our community is. I say this because many of you do this. You come in from El Camino onto Monroe, and everybody has their own route. I turn right, I go around that curve, and then I come to the driveway. So it's extremely familiar, and you know, see all the cars, and you know a lot of the people. Everything is there. We've lived there almost 30 years. So I was listening to a CD of Swamiji, and he just said something. You know how it is, you have a CD, like I've had the CD in my car for how long, right? In fact, I was listening to the radio, but it just was so depressing that I just couldn't listen to it. So I thought, huh, is there a CD in here? So I discovered there was, I pushed it back in, and then Swami starts giving me a message, just like Babaji falling on my chest. He says, the entire creation is set up for the for individual self-realization, and there's absolutely no other purpose to it. And I've just been listening to the news, and I've been listening to this country and this election and that one and this strident person and this strident person and this self-righteous one and that self-righteous one, you know, and they're all, everybody takes themselves so seriously. You know, we're all so extraordinarily real to ourselves. That's the most, I still can't quite get over it. I mean, I know I've been human for a long time, and it still just puzzles me how we can all be so extraordinarily real to ourselves and rarely see the humor of it, rarely recognize just how comical it must look to the divine. So I'm going around the corner, and Swami says that the only purpose of all of creation, the only purpose of all of this is for individual souls to have the experience they need so that they can attain self-realization. And I think about all those houses there, and you know, the little houses are being torn down and big new houses are being built, and I know all the process of that and the choosing of the fixtures and the lamps, and everybody's just running their life. And we do progress as human beings through the stages of the castes, the four castes of spiritual evolution, from complete lazy passivity to creativity for self-interest to self-sacrificing discipline to finally to God attunement. And it isn't possible to go from just passive laziness to God attunement. Everyone has to move through all of those stages. And that's what this creation was set up for. It was set up so that all of us, to refer to our Bible today, as prodigal sons, sort of manifested in this world for who knows what reason, with all of our attention looking outward and trying to figure out sort of what the rules of the game are, and then what skills are required, and then how to play it, and then finally, really, what the goal really is, and then finally to achieve it. So all of those stages are necessary. So I look at the people building the new house, and I think how much, you know, determined energy it took in order to get the resources to be able to do that, the concentration that's required in order to make the house. I mean, there's just all these different steps, which in an immature understanding of spiritual life, you can just dismiss. Oh, it's not real. It doesn't matter. In my very, very early days of spiritual life, before I found Swami, I was part of a little coterie of spiritually minded people, and one of whom became a thief because he worked it out that if it's all a dream, what difference does it make? You know, so there's a kind of like a creative self-interest that we get going here that is not quite the same, but is better than just passive laziness. You know, having the creativity to become dishonest is better than just sitting there like a lump and not even caring enough to be dishonest. Because all of it is necessary as we sort of move our way forward. So when I look at these people building a house that, to my mind, would be just a nightmare, you know, just a burden of responsibility that I really would not want to have, at the same time, I'm not going to dismiss it. Now, Swamiji says another aspect of this, which is very, very interesting. It's very difficult for us to get our minds around the fact that the masters, every self-realized master is made of the same stuff that we are made of. They don't really have something that we don't have. They just make use of everything that they have. And their progress to the state of mastery that makes them self-realized masters is exactly the path of experience that each one of us is walking. And their compassion is because I've stood in your shoes. I understand why you feel that way. I can see why that seemed like a good idea to you. Even though in the end it may have not brought you what you wanted, literally the master can say, I remember. And it doesn't take discipline then for them to feel compassion and offer us wisdom, because it's a path that they themselves have walked. So Swamiji made a comment in another talk just saying that means that every single experience that we have must be necessary. Because if it wasn't necessary, if the only purpose of this creation is to move us to self-realization, then everything that happens in this creation must be purposeful. Now, how much time it takes is, I'm not touching the question of free will. You know, that's not really the issue. I'm working at it from a different side, which is our capacity to persevere and our capacity to recover, you know, day after day. It's so interesting to me, because when you come back from a journey, especially when you go on an organized pilgrimage, which I did, which was only 10 days, but nonetheless, it was long enough. On an organized pilgrimage, I'm an extremely good pilgrim because I've been a pilgrimage leader many times, so I know exactly how to behave to make it work perfectly. And that is a total surrender to whatever's happening. You can't hold on to any, where are we going, what time are we going to get there, is this the most efficient route, could we really have been sitting over there, do we have to spend as much time on breakfast, why didn't they serve us? You know, you just don't go there. You don't go there at all. You just show up. Where am I supposed to be? When am I supposed to be there? And toward the end, I became interested, but much of the time, I just said, where are we? You know, I knew generally that it was about Jesus, and I was curious, you know, where are we? And so, but when you come home again, of course, all the requirements of life, it usually starts with me when it's time to go down to breakfast, and there's no going down to breakfast. You know, there's going to the store and making breakfast and then washing the dishes and all those things. That's usually the thunk moment for me. Oh yeah, everything ends and we go on to the next. And more than that, of course, one has responsibilities. I have responsibilities. And things have to be done. And you just wake up in the morning and you just think, isn't there an alternative? You know, isn't there an alternative to this endless, disciplined effort? And of course, the answer is no. You know, because the bottom of the scale is that I just collapse into a laziness and hope that in unconsciousness and low energy, this profound longing of my heart will be fulfilled. And it's an extremely seductive idea. And it's by no means anything that we ever really put behind us. You know, you come back from a long trip and you're jet lagged and you've been away for a while and maybe you could just keep sleeping, you know, and maybe it doesn't really have to be done. And then you just feel, here we are again. The only purpose of this life is self-realization, and self-realization is absolute self-forgetfulness. You know, this is what happens when we have a good meditation. And what sometimes happens on a pilgrimage is that you have lots of good meditations. And that's really, really 100% of what's happening. And a good meditation is the sudden realization that I don't exist. That all of this worry and anxiety and concern and grief and longing and, well, you can all make your own list. Physical discomfort, fear of death, worry about money, concern about my relatives, pain about my children, on and on and on it goes. Life. Who in the room doesn't have some of it? I'm sitting here with you. And that is the reality that we are, oddly enough, trying to escape. But that seems what life is, isn't it? That's the whole of it. Then you have a good meditation, whether it's in your ordinary meditation room, whether it's driving down the street and suddenly something turns in your head, whether it's walking in nature, whatever it might be. And for one brief moment, whatever it might be, you're just simply not there anymore. In the course of this journey, the woman who was leading it, an Italian woman named Premi, had read a lot about the visionaries of Medjugorje. There were five or six. They were children when they started, but the visions have gone on literally for decades. And she's read a lot about what they say and what they experience. And one of the visionaries, Mirjana, said that when the Virgin Mary comes, and she still comes either once a month, one of the visionaries sees her every day, and one of them sees her, I think, once a month. I may have those details wrong, but it's something like that. But she said, when the Virgin Mary comes, what happens is everything else is forgotten. Just everything else is forgotten. And there's one reality, and that reality is her experience of love and compassion and oneness. Now, what you have to understand, and this is what the visionary herself tried to explain, it's not like she stands in herself and sees something beautiful. I mean, that happens to us a lot. We stand in ourselves, we see something beautiful. You see a beautiful piece of art, you see a beautiful scene in nature, you see an absolutely wonderful child. You see the person that you love most in the world, and you stand in yourself and you see that. And God knows these are wonderful experiences. But what she described is that self is forgotten. And all that exists is that experience, simply love, simply freedom, simply bliss. And she said, then, of course, the vision ends, and then she's back. Now, of course, knowing that influences everything, but still, that's the dance that we're in all the time, which is we're called to all these experiences, and in the course of life, in ordinary life, we use our willpower to make a good life for ourselves. This is what people do. And everyone who comes to the spiritual path has progressed through those castes to the point where we have a certain creative capacity to make our life happen. That doesn't mean we're highly successful in this world or really know how to manipulate it or run the rules of the game or anything like that. In fact, if the world works too well for you, you tend not to really want to renounce it. That's a different stage. But nonetheless, the idea of a good life is I get a good career and I carry it out and I raise my children well and I build a good house and maybe I go live in another country for a while and, you know, I master these skills and there's no harm in it. I'm mature enough spiritually now to recognize those are the necessary experiences for us to learn. But it's not an end in itself. The whole point of it, weirdly, is for us to cease to exist to ourselves. Now, we always read about the prodigal son and, you know, his adventures, and we didn't read the whole thing about how he ends up in foreign lands and he ends up tending the pigs for some gross person, and the pigs eat better than he does. I mean, it's a really vivid tale. And you see this guy who was once on top of the world and was the gifted son of a wealthy man, and he went out there with his inheritance, and he was just going to enjoy himself. And we usually see the story from the point of view of God's forgiveness, but I was hearing it today from the point of view of the prodigal son. You know, here we are. Look at us. We're smart. We're talented. We can make money. We can get what we want. And we just go out there and we make it happen. And it never crosses our mind that this isn't what we should be doing. And we just keep reaching for those experiences. And in a certain way, we are compelled to do it. It's not as if there's a point at which we can just stop. Our karma is pushing us. These vortices of energy are pushing us. We're on this track. God knows that we need to do it. And that's the point before repentance, is the realization, even as we're going along, that if there was a choice, we would take it. If there was an alternative for true freedom, God would open that door. I know I've shared with you this point, but certain aspects of the spiritual path get clearer and clearer to me the longer I'm on it. We spend an enormous amount of our time wishing there was an easier way to do it. I remember I've shared with you, I had a conversation with Swamiji once. He was sitting behind a table. I can't think of where he would have been, behind a desk, but he was sitting somewhere, makes me feel like he was behind a desk. Where would he have been? Maybe he was just sitting next to something, because there was a phone on the table. That was part of it. And we were talking, and I was saying, you know, everything in my life is going well except this one aspect, and this one aspect is so exhausting to me, and it's just such a hard thing. I was very upset. It was not a calm conversation. But when I finally finished what I said, I didn't exactly say it like this, but it was so close. I said, if it weren't so hard, it would be easier. And Swamiji just looked at me. I've hardly ever gotten that response from him, which was an absolutely non-response. It was like he simply didn't know what to say. What I wanted him to do was to change divine law, you know, open like a side door somewhere and just push me through it. Hey, how about it, sir? You know, I've been serving this work for a long time. You know, let's make a deal. That's more or less what I was asking. You know, just show me a way that I don't have to face this limitation in myself. He wasn't being unkind. He was just, there was simply no response. It's really that it reminds me of a story some of you have heard also. When we had this house in San Francisco, we, the collective, the royal we, meaning Ananda, had a five-story mansion up on Broadway in San Francisco, and had this huge staircase going up through the middle, and the house was all wood. And when you stood on that staircase, well, actually, when you stood pretty well anywhere in the house, you could hear it through the whole 45 rooms of the house. And this little boy who was 3 years old at that time, who had tremendous willpower, really got tired. He really did not enjoy being a child. Being a child was really a nuisance to him, because he could feel that he had all this potential, but none of it could be expressed. And he woke up early one morning, like 3. Nobody else was up, and he got really bored. And so he climbed out of his bed, and he walked to the top of the staircase, and he shouted out to the whole house, I want it to be morning, just like that. I've had it with this dark. I've had it with being alone. I've had it with this expectation that I'm supposed to sleep just because all of you are sleeping. I want it to be morning. And that to me has always just like, I find myself in that position. If it weren't so hard, it would be easier. You know, I want it to be morning. I want it to be over. I want it to be over. I want those good meditations to become my constant consciousness. And that's the prodigal son. And that's how he got himself out there with all those pigs. You know, I have this money. I'm just going to spend it. My father's giving me my inheritance. I'm going to indulge myself. I'm not going to invest it. I'm not going to think about it. I'm just going to spend it. I have this energy, I have this youth, I have this passion, I'm just going to spend it. And then when it's all gone, I'm going to be out there with the pigs, and the pigs will be eating better than me. And then I'll just be angry about it, or be disappointed, or sad, or, you know, why did this happen? Where did I go wrong? You know, like these sorts of things. But unfortunately, you see, these are the necessary experiences. But that's why when we finally turn back to God and say, well, that didn't work very well. Seemed like a good idea at the time, but being out there with the pigs didn't really work. So now I've come back. There's nothing to forgive. I mean, who did anything to anybody? There's nothing to forgive. It's like, well, I've learned a little something. And God says, great, let's go on from here. And he can't take away from us what we still, for our ignorance. He can just comfort us while we gather ourselves together and then just go out there and try again. But having that sure knowledge that there's no way that we can fail or that we can disappoint. You know, one of the things that our self-consciousness, self-concern creates for us constantly is anxiety about our performance, doesn't it? An anxiety about our potential for success or failure. You know, we all just muddle along. We have so many incarnations. We have so many incarnations. So often you go to a psychic and they'll say, well, you've done it 12 times, 12 times. You've done it 12,000 times, 12 million times. You know, there's this awful image that they, I say awful because it's so disconcerting. How long does it take to realize God? Well, if there's a lake of such scope that you cannot see the boundaries of it, and every 5,000 years a bird flies over a high mountain and fills its beak with water and then flies away, as long as it takes for the bird to empty the lake, that's how long it takes to realize God. Oh my God, you know. Swami, a master, said when he came to America, he said, in India, they understand that realizing God is very, very difficult. And people tend to say, well, maybe next lifetime, maybe next lifetime. He said, Americans, he said, you Americans have so much confidence in yourself that, he said, when I came to this country and said, let's realize God, we all said, sure, we can do it. And he loved that spirit. And it's true, sure, we can do it. And we can. And the beauty of it, the most important thing, is it's not like nothing and then everything. It's not like, as Swami said, it's a barren desert and then it flowers. It's an ever-increasing remembrance. And that's all we're doing. Smriti is this wonderful, untranslatable word. There's no equivalent in English. It means divine memory. Oh my goodness, this is who I actually am. Here I am in the pigs, with the pigs, eating worse than the pigs. But I'm really not a servant of this selfish man. I'm actually the son of a rich man. Oh yeah, I can just go back. Every time in my life, and there have been lots of them, when I find myself someplace I don't want to be, I have to say to myself, how did you get here? You got here by inches, making one bad decision at a time, and all you have to do is turn around. Now, it may be a very long walk. There's just, what can you say? If you've walked very far, that poor prodigal son had gotten really far out there. But once he remembered, once Smriti comes in, and what happens on the spiritual path... What happens on the spiritual path is that Smriti asserts itself more and more often. So that even in the worst of times, a little piece of you still remembers. You know? And that sounds so small. We think the spiritual path is touch me on the chest and it's all free. But that's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary difference. Just an extraordinary difference. I am the child of the infinite. No matter where I go, no matter what I do, as soon as I hold out my arms to my divine mother, as soon as I call on my heavenly father, instantly I am back with him. The only thing that separates us is our lack of attunement. Every master is exactly like us. They're just using what they have and remembering that they have it. So simple, not easy, but so simple. God bless you.
This is some beautiful mystic poetry by Omar Khayyam from the Rubaiyat about the soul's journey. Awake from morning in the pool of night, has flung the stone that puts the stars to flight. And lo, the hunter of the east has caught the sultan's turret in a noose of light.
The worldly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes, or it prospers and anon. Like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lighting a little, hour or two is gone.
The moving finger writes on having writ, moves on nor all thy piety nor wit shall lure it back to counsel.
Here with a loaf of bread beneath the bough, a flask of wine, a book of verse, and thou. Beside me singing in the wilderness, and wilderness is paradise.
Through the seventh gate I rose, and on the throne of Saturn sate. And many knots unraveled by the road, but not the knot of human death and fate.
There was a door to which I found no key. There was a veil past which I could not see. Some little talk, a while of me and thee, there seemed, and there no more of me and thee.
Who knowest no wane, the moon of heaven is rising once again. How oft hereafter rising shall she look through this same garden after me in vain.
And when thyself its shining foot shall pass among the guests, stars scattered on the grass, and in thy joyous errand reach the spot where I made wonder.